I don't really know what fudge rounds are, but they sound delicious. I'd like a bag. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today, we are going to be going through the song Richmond, North of Richmond. So we'll be reading through the lyrics, and I'll be doing a little bit of commenting along the way. This song has gotten a wee bit out of control. My brother was at a redneck gas station earlier in the morning, and he witnessed a sing-along. Somebody rolled up in his truck with this song playing, and before you know it, everybody at every pump, the entire gas station, had decided to sing along. So this is a bit of a cultural phenomenon, I think one worth addressing. I mean, if we break down Taylor Swift songs, then we should certainly be breaking down this one. The first point I want to make is that this is indeed quite sad. It's depressing. You hear it in the guy's voice that this guy is deeply distressed. And this is a lot of the reason why I think blue-collar workers are resonating to it. They feel like, particularly during the lockdowns, they were told by society to just shut up and make society run and just deal with it. And this is a class of people who are truly awful at expressing their emotions with anything other than cigarettes and swear words. So being told by the laptop class that just, oh, get the things running, do the gross, dirty, grimy things so that we can continue to sip our lattes and have food delivered to us. Oh, woe is me. What a difficult life. That's deeply distressing. They felt dishonored. And I think that's a legitimate gripe that they were put upon. And I think at other times in our society, we saw people who took up difficult blue-collar work as heroic in some sense. And I think that's kind of gone. I think we spent any goodwill as society, and this is kind of the expression of that. It's a deep sadness, it's a betrayal, and yeah, it's an anger against people who they view as having it better than themselves. All right, so the first lyric is, I've been selling my soul, working all day. Oftentimes we think that working all day means that you are selling your soul, you're losing your individuality, you are losing your life itself because you are engaged in all-day work. I don't think that has to be that way. Work is not bad. Work is good. Work is humanizing. Work is what God did and asked us to model. So working all day, well, that can be great. We can enjoy that. But I want to make a few distinctions here. You might think I'd make a distinction between maybe fun or enjoyable or safe work versus work which is gross or dirty or hard or inconvenient with terrible hours, etc. That's not the distinction I want to make. I want to make a distinction between a type of humanizing work and just toil. Humanizing work, more than anything, is work taken up because of some type of impelling love. And toil is just something that's thrust upon you that you deal with and you wish to escape. Now, in the first category, those people who take up difficult work because of something that they love, that impels them to take on these difficult tasks, we should call those people heroes. That's a heroic thing to do. And then the second group, people who have no reason or impelling love, they just thrust upon them is terrible work. That's toilsome and difficult, and those are victims. So heroes and victims are what I want to talk about. And oftentimes we find more heroes amongst the worst work. One of the worst possible jobs I can think of is being a soldier, especially historically. Few things are more filthy, dangerous. Nothing really has much worse hours than that. You're away from your family. It's psychologically damaging. You're poorly paid. It's incredibly strict. You have very little autonomy. Pretty much anything bad you could say about any job would be found there in the military. And yet, some of the greatest men, some of the most honored and respected men of all time have come out of the military. You think of the legends of Achilles and Hector and Odysseus. Think of the biblical characters of Samson, Joshua, David, the historical characters of Marcus Aurelius, Julius Caesar, Napoleon, mythical characters like King Arthur, Sir Lancelot, and even enemy characters who are remembered in pizzas, like the Red Baron, right? Many people know who the Red Baron was. It was somebody who engaged in terrible, difficult work and was a hero for the wrong side, but was nevertheless taking on very difficult work and for some reason, for some impelling love. Each one of those cases, there was an impelling love which caused these people to take on these incredibly hard tasks. So when we hear the plight of the worker, I think many people jump to how could we make their lives easier? How could we make it so they don't have to work all day anymore? That's entirely the wrong direction. I think we need to ask the question, why is it they don't feel like there's anything that they're working for? Why is it that they don't have some type of impelling love? Why is it that they can't take on this work as a hero and instead they feel just battered about like a victim? That should really be the question. Overtime hours for bullshit pay. If this is the only reason, pay, then yeah, any type of work, any type of difficulty, you're always going to be weighing against what you get. But if instead you feel like you get something more than just pay from your work, well, that can really help out a lot. And every business school will teach you that you need some type of reason why. You need a why at the heart of your business. And that's just plain old good management. So in one respect, I think employers should be careful to not just compensate people with pay, but also try to hook them into a mission and help them understand that what they're doing, the value that they're creating, is important. And if it's not, well, maybe you need to rethink your business model. But in pretty much any legitimate job you can take up, there is a why to that job. You can understand yourself as being plugged into society and giving a great gift to others. And that needs to be part of your focus. If it's only myopic, if it's only what you get out of it and not what you're giving, then you're always going to be just weighing the cost of every single slight and difficulty and inconvenience relative to your work. Now, I listened to most of a Jordan Peterson interview with this with the singer. I think he goes by Oliver Anthony. His real name's Christopher something and rather. He did have in his personal life a couple impelling loves. So in a sense, his actual life is at a bit of a discord with what he sings in his song. He decided to sell everything he had, save up a bunch of money, cancel a bunch of debt, and buy a huge plot of land, start living there. And that's cool. He cast a vision for himself, for his family. They took that on, and they did it. That's why you see him in these music videos where he's surrounded by the woods. Those are his. That's his land. That was his vision. He did it. So when he went to work, it wasn't just that there was meaning inside of that work, but there was meaning outside of that work. He had something he was working towards. He was providing something for his wife, for his kids. He was setting himself up a little kingdom, a little lot of land. And that's wonderful. That's something that I think should be valued. I will point out that this isn't something that should be expected. A lot of the more trad movement Catholics and just trad movement people in general seem to think that they're somehow entitled to land. And it's really funny the historical perspectives they'll put out, you know, different memes of this was a peasant in the 1300s and it's this massive house and it's all this land and cattle. And no, that's not how it worked. The average plight for a peasant back in the day was that they had no land. They had a terrible house. They had basic subsistence living and somebody else owned the land. And the split was you do whatever the nobles say, and in compensation, if somebody comes to try to kill you and take everybody's stuff and rip away your wife and kids, well, then the nobles will protect you. So that was the deal, the bargain in many times in many places. I don't think that we should expect that we are somehow entitled to a massive amount of land and whatnot. This is aspirational, and the singer here in his personal life understands this, set that out as a goal, and accomplished it. And I bet you that that did a lot to ease the difficulty of those overtime hours, of that difficult work which he's describing. So I can sit out here and waste my life away, drag back home and drown my troubles away. Again, that's a discord with this guy's actual life. He has a wife. He has something like 3 kids. So how on earth is caring and supporting for one's family wasting your life away and drowning your troubles? This guy did have a purpose. He wasn't a do-nothing. He took on something difficult and he achieved it. I don't like the fact that this guy is, in a sense, normalizing this attitude as applied to the worker. I don't think it should be, not at all. I think that's a victim mentality. It's not a hero mentality. It's one where you're just caving in on oneself. You're just being myopic. You're saying that you are sitting and wasting your life away. You're not active in bettering it. You're dragging yourself back home and drowning your troubles away. You're simply trying to escape. That's not what we want to set up. Now, for those who are in that case, these people deserve our help, support, sympathy, yes. But what I don't like is the normalization as this attitude is the plight of the worker. That is a problem. It's a damn shame what the world's gotten to for people like me and for people like you. Marcus Aurelius says, if you're distressed by anything external, the pain is not due to the thing itself, but to your estimation of it. In this, you have the power to revoke at any moment. There's no more destructive mindset than placing blame only externally. So it's a damn shame what the world has gotten to for people like me and for people like you. That's just not going to be helpful. That's not a recipe for success. Marcus Aurelius would tell us, hey, maybe the world is whatever, but you need to deal with your own internal state. You need to think about, am I overestimating this object that I'm thinking about? And if so, you should revoke that power over you. You should just say no to the world disrupting your peace, to the world disrupting your own family life, your own purpose, your own pursuit of things which you believe are valuable. You can revoke the world's power over you in that respect, and you should. And you should probably look first at the ways that you, as the only agent that you can possibly control, can take action in your own life before just pushing off the world's problems onto the world. Maybe you should see what part of the world's problems you yourself can take up. But let's take on one specific thing, which I hear literally all the time, that the world has changed and it's caused a problem for people. And here's one change. I hear quite often that, yes, I want to form a family. Yes, I want to have kids. Yes, I want to do these things. But where on earth am I going to live? How am I going to afford a house? And it's true. We have run up costs like crazy. That is a barrier, and I have many things to say about it. And I have far too much data in my notes, so I'm not going to bore you with all of it. I'm just going to bore you with some of it. If you look at the Great Recession and you go 7 years before and 7 years after, so we look at that 14-year span, we go from a home affordability index of 4.7 to 5.7. What's that mean? It means that it takes, in the latter year, 5.7 years worth of the median salary to purchase the median home, or average home. I think I have that right. I think it's median to median. Anyways, now one might think, well, clearly we certainly had a run-up in housing costs, right? This is totally not fair. The world is changing around us, just screwing us. Well, I actually looked at the average sale in each one of those years, and I looked at how many square feet these homes were, and it turns out that that run-up in approximately 20% of cost tracks perfectly perfectly, with a 20% run-up in the size of the house. So that's a very large factor. As houses have gotten way bigger. In 1920, the average size was 1,048 square feet. By 1960, it was 1,289. By 1980, it was 1,740. By the year 2000, it was 2,266. By 2014, it was 2,657. So you get 2.5 times more house than you did back at the beginning of the data. Oh, 1950, 943 square feet. They were building some tiny stuff over there, and home affordability was terrible. We only just went above the 1950 level, which, granted, people coming back from the war, shortages of supply. So that's the first thing I want to point out is we've been demanding larger size. Also, we've been demanding more features, granite countertops, larger things, vaulted ceilings, air conditioning, insulation. So things are getting higher quality. Things are getting way larger. That's a big reason. So when we say, oh, the world's changed, and I, it's just hard on people like me and people like you. We do have to make sure we're comparing apples to apples. Sometimes you hear people say, well, my grandfather was able to support a whole family just on one income. Yeah, that can be true. And listen, I understand that criticism, and there are things we can do about affordability, about wages, about things like that. Yes, certainly. But we have to keep things in perspective. That quality of products has risen astronomically, the quantity of products astronomically, and the size and scale of these higher quality and more diverse different products that we enjoy have also increased. So that's a little bit of the examples I'll give there. Maybe I should do a how to fix it episode, but briefly, we need to bring down fixed costs, regulations, open up labor by removing red tape, occupational licensing, remove square footage requirements. The list goes on and on. But this is not an episode on housing. It's an episode on people complaining about the ways that the world has changed such that they cannot have what they expect. So my point here is that you need to expect something reasonable and not something that just climbs by 1,000 square feet every couple decades. Need to have our expectations reasonable. Because realistically, we live in a wonderful, wonderful world. And especially if you're listening in the U.S. And in other extraordinarily wealthy countries, you have an enormous amount to be thankful for. And about this whole, we aren't wealthy enough to raise kids, it turns out that my African listeners, shout out to my African listeners, raise 2 to 3 times more kids than my European and American listeners, while being way less wealthy on average. So that's a bit of a problem. And here in the U.S., it turns out that the poorest among us actually have more kids than the middle class. And then it climbs again once we get to wealthier people. So I wouldn't say that there's a terribly good correlation between the amount of income one has in the U.S. and the amount of kids. And globally, if anything, it goes the other way. So I don't think anything is really stopping us from making modest households, frugally raising kids, getting married, and living a life which we ought to have a reasonable expectation for, not an ever-rising or aspirational one. If you want to have an aspirational one, that's great, but you need to understand it as such. You are not owed, and you should not expect 100 acres and a beautiful farmhouse and all of the equipment that goes on with owning and operating such a large estate. No. You got to have a little bit more reasonable expectations. Otherwise, you're going to be disappointed. Wish I could just wake up and it not be true, but it is. Oh, it is. Oh, I have a few more things. Average hours worked, if you look at things like that, the poorer class works less than the richer class. If you look at hours worked by income strata, and the average American is still watching 3 hours of television per day. So, okay, this idea that we're in some type of nightmare that we just need to wake up out of, Not really. People have leisure time. People work less when they're poorer. We have an extraordinarily generous welfare state, which I think is an object of criticism. And this song rightfully makes that criticism a little bit later on. But no, we're not in a nightmarish world. I'll add another thing. Recently, I believe it was either this year or last year, job satisfaction peaked to an all-time high. Our jobs are better. We are wealthier. And although crime has ticked up a little bit, if you compare it to like the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, it's come down substantially. All right, so things aren't that bad. Living in the new world with an old soul. I don't really know what to say about this, but I guess it's this identifying with this past and then expectations that the world ought to somehow meet it. I think we've addressed a little bit of that, and not all that's reasonable. If we're talking about expectations for a society that you can be engaged in, then maybe that's reasonable, and maybe you should be seeking out and finding that. Expectations that you can form a family, I think most people can. I think a lot of the expectations that are kind of the old soul ideas, old values, many of those are still possible. But keeping up with the Joneses ought not be one of those. These rich men north of Richmond, Lord knows they all just want total control. Well, yeah, that is kind of the primordial temptation of man, is you will be as God, and we are fighting spiritual wickedness in high places. There are people who just seek to have control, be it in government, be it in any walk of society, and they do it just to have control over others. Not always, not everybody, but certainly the evil ones, which are quite prevalent. And we should call that out. We should recognize that. And we should also recognize that when we vote, when we craft policies, we need to understand that the people that we hand power to when we hand power to government are people who simply want control, who think themselves to be gods. If you've met many politicians, you understand these are not the world's most humble individuals. They want to know what you think, want to know what you do, and they don't think that you know, but I know that you do. Evil wants the kind of omni-properties that belong to God. All power, all presence, all knowledge. These things we as people seek after. And then we wish to lord them over our fellow man. That's when we're at our worst. And that needs to be called out. That's right. And I also like that this is taking a bit of a jab at the whole techopoly or whatever it's called. Yeah, they're spying on you, etc. And I like that he kind of calls out the fact that we're certainly privy to what's going on here. Well, let's keep on going. So some of these critiques, reasonable. We got to think about what's actionable and what's not. But the next one I really like. 'Cause your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end. 'Cause of Richmond, north of Richmond. Now, okay, maybe it's not because of the rich people that you are highly taxed. Rich people pay pretty much all taxes in the United States, and most people are net tax receivers when you look at all the benefits and whatnot. So it's not because of the rich men, but I do think we're taxed to no end. That is, it's ridiculous. If you just sit back and think of all of the things that you consume, all the things that make your life better, the food at the grocery store, electricity, let's see, your house, your car, gasoline, your phone service, the list goes on and on, everything, your clothes, think about everything. What amount of those did you purchase from the government? What quantity of each one of those products was, like, what quantity of the value of those products was produced by the government? I don't know. If anything, they're hindering a lot of the production of these things. It's pretty small, right? So given that the value that people actually get from the government is so small, take a guess at how much government spending makes up of GDP, gross domestic product. Yes, unfortunately, mid to high 40s, almost 50% of GDP. That's ridiculous. So they spend half the money, and what do people get in return? I know what you're thinking. Well, you know, somebody's got to pay for the roads. Yes, for state and local, that's about 6% of just state and local budget. And if you're thinking highways, A, they're already built. And second, the inflation adjusted $1.2 trillion for, how much did it cost? No, it cost $600 billion for the entire interstate highway system. And I think inflation adjusted, I'm trying to remember that. I don't have it in my notes. I think that works out to a little over $1 trillion or something. Anyways, what I do know is that the bipartisan, not even the radical one, but the compromise infrastructure bill spends $1.2 trillion. So with that amount of money, we could have rebuilt multiple times the entire interstate highway system. That's insane. That is insane. So, no, roads aren't chewing up much of this. There's all sorts of things that are. Education's one, but that's not going great. So this critique that your dollar does not spend very far, yeah, it's because of government cost inflation. It's taxed to no end. Yes, it is taxed to no end. So either this spending is covered by taxes, at which point, yeah, tax to no end is a fair critique. You are not getting any value for this. Or it's actually degrading the value of your dollar through deficit spending and then subsequent borrowing, such as increasing the quantity of dollars and driving down the buying power. So, yes, I do like this line. That's a fair critique. Our government is terrible. And maybe we'll need to do some episodes, specific things to fix it. I'll kick in another thing. An old Heritage Foundation study found that a single mom bears $17,000 of additional cost in her life because of regulatory burdens on companies and other institutions who have to then comply and raise their prices. That's insane. You find me one of those single moms who goes, yeah, no, actually, I would buy those regulations back. I would. Mm-hmm. It's worth it. No, none of them think that. I wish politicians would look out for minors, not just minors on an island somewhere. Yes, guys, Jeffrey Epstein did not kill himself, no. And we do have some sick and perverse people among us, and particularly in our political class. That's true. Just another reason we shouldn't be passing so much power to them. And we're going to get to this minors point, because I think that really breaks open this whole song. At the end of this episode, I think I have a key distinction that really makes sense of why this is striking home for so many. Lord, we got folks in the street, ain't got nothing to eat, and the obese milk and welfare. You know, people in the street without anything to eat. This is not a depression. We're not in a depression. Maybe a recession recently in some quarters. But here's the thing. As far as an employment market, we have way more jobs than unemployed people. It's not even close. There's no reason that somebody is going without work. This isn't the Dust Bowl or the Great Depression. I think this kind of critique that there's people in the streets. No, that's probably because of mental health issues, drug addiction. That's the reason why people are in the streets. And I'd rather have people focus on that. And I don't just mean government. I mean social action. I mean ecclesial action. And I mean personal action. If you see somebody in the street, that's somebody's brother. That's somebody's sister. That's somebody's kid. That's somebody's dad. Where's their family? Now, oftentimes they don't want help from their families. There's nothing you can do. But really, we need social action on those kind of issues. This isn't an economic problem. The obese are milking welfare. Oh, yes, yes, yes. This is certainly true. I was a landlord, and I owned a bunch of lower-income housing, some of which I participated in some government programs where they would cover most, if not all, of the rent for these people. So I got a good peek into a lot of people's finances, into how they spend their money, into what their mentality is, and milking welfare is a real thing, gang. It certainly is. So another good critique here. If you're 5'3" and you're 300 pounds, taxes ought not pay for your bags of fudge rounds. Now that is the killer line of the song right there, guys. Plato argued against socializing any cost that's your fault. I believe he made that specifically in the Republic with regards to healthcare. So I think we should take his advice. If you are 300 pounds because of bag after bag of delicious fudge rounds, maybe we don't cover the, or at least we don't socialize the cost of treatments which are your own fault, because that's not actually good for you. That's not going to help you towards virtue. That's going to pave a beautiful path towards vice. Allowing people early and often to meet the natural consequences of their own bad decisions is a wonderful, merciful, and just thing that we can do that would make society better. Constantly trying to guard against any possible pain or difficulty to just make up for and fix any type of issue that people might have, that's not going to be conducive to virtue. It's just not. Young men are putting themselves 6 feet in the ground because all this damn country does is keep kicking them down. Now, the suicide rate is concerning. And yeah, we are kicking men down in a lot of ways. Society saying that masculinity is bad, that people are racist, that calling these obese people obese, well, that's terrible. You should call them beautiful. We have red tape and regulations and restrictions which stop creative people from enjoying their creative drive and seeing the fruits of their labor. Like, there are problems here. But again, we can't just put them all external. We also have people indulging in video games, porn, fast food, things which are just self-destructive. So it's not just that the country is kicking people down. People kick themselves down and need to take responsibility, because it doesn't matter at the end of the day whose fault something is. It matters what each of us can do from here. So if you're somebody who feels like you've been kicked down in some way, well, okay, whatever. Maybe you have. But the only thing to do now is to get up and figure out where you can go from here, what you can use today to better yourself. I heard a clinical psychiatrist say that he estimated over 80% of even his serious clients would be cured with adequate sleep, regular exercise, and a healthy diet. That's pretty impressive. If we add into that maybe a social outlet, a regular job, financial prudence, and then we layer on top spiritual things like prayer, sacraments, study, care for others, there's not much those people can do to kick you down if you take up those steps. And that really needs to be our focus. None of those things are stopped by the rich men north of Richmond. And it goes on and it repeats all of this. So here's what I want to point out. There's a lot of resonance in this song. It's tapping into something deep. And I don't think it's just a resentment against the upper class. I don't think it's just the economic critique. I don't think it's a Marxist impulse necessarily. And here's what I think it is. But let me pause real quick, because I realized I am recording in my my little baby son's room, where I have a white noise machine ruining my audio quality. So let me pause right here, and we're going to take up what I think is really at the core of this. There is a distinction to be made between tenacity and persistence. And let me just give a brief definition here. Tenacity is taking on a task and immediately trying thing after thing after thing to accomplish that task. Persistence is taking on a task and trying one thing repeatedly without being daunted or discouraged in order to complete the task. So you would want your mechanic to be tenacious, to try to fix your car by changing the alternator and saying, oh, that wasn't it. All right, maybe it's the starter. Oh, that wasn't it. All right, maybe there's a wiring problem. Oh, that wasn't it. Let me try another thing. He needs to be tenacious. If you hired a bricklayer, you would want him to be persistent, putting brick after brick after brick without stopping until the entire house or the entire wall is built. If your mechanic was not tenacious and he was instead persistent, and you come up the next morning, "Hey, how's my car?" "Well, I've been working all day changing your alternator 15, 16, 17 times for bullshit pay." You'd be like, "Buddy, what's wrong? You've just been changing my alternator again and again and again?" Like, "Yeah, I've been working hard." Well, you'd be quite disturbed by that. Likewise, if he found your bricklayers being very tenacious, saying, "No, let's try another brick. No, you know what? I'm going to remix my mortar. You know, different kind of mortar. This trowel's no good. Let me get a new trowel. What if I did the string line like that? Where's my plumb bob? Maybe I should try a different type of plumb bob." No, you wouldn't want that. You'd want him to just get a good method and just chug along. Now, some people, just by a natural temperament, gravitate to either tenacity or persistence, though we all have some blend of these. I think this is a song of the persistent, people who almost don't understand tenacity. And he's invoking the values of persistence here. I mean, a few of the lyrics are working all day, selling my soul, overtime hours. He's identifying with miners. And just think about a miner's culture. You don't have people who are tenacious, just swinging a pickaxe. "Hey guys, what if we use a shovel? Hey, what if we use this? Hey, do you have dynamite?" No, you just need them going down to the mines again and again and again and swinging a pick against a wall and shoveling things out. That's persistence. That's hard. It's not tenacity, though. Now, I'm not saying one is better than the other. Both are quite necessary, but to different degrees in different professions. Now, this guy, appealing to the miners, appealing to people who are persistent, well, it makes sense that they would be upset by a changing world because they're trying the same thing that they've always seen work, and it's failing. And their self-worth is from being persistent. That's how they've always seen people get ahead, is just being tough, head down, and going through the same way. And can you just imagine how frustrating that would be if one day that doesn't work? Well, that casts doubt on you? That casts doubt on society? And where do you even go to escape from that? That's hard. Now, the good thing about persistent people is that they're stable, they're predictable, they have a built-in conservative streak, they value tradition, and they guard against downside risk. They're going to pick something that they are confident will work, and they will make sure that they execute that. The good thing about tenacious people is that they're constantly looking for the best things, the new angles. Downside is they fail often, they're sometimes wasteful, and they're totally fine with breaking tradition, which can cut both ways. Some traditions are great and some needs to be broken. But both of these mindsets are certainly at their best when paired with humility, because the persistent person learns from the best patiently. That should really be the first move to say, "All right, I know where I'm at, and let me look around and find out who's really doing well right now, and then use my persistence to do what they're doing." That's a move which begins in humility and self-reflection, and then harnesses the virtue of persistence. And then when things go wrong, humility helps persistent people self-reflect and say, maybe it's not just society, but maybe I could try a little tenacity. Or if that's not really me, maybe I can just ask other people, "Hey, what are you doing that's working? And how can I be persistent in that task?" As far as humility with respect to tenacity, well, that recognizes the real risk of failure, and it guards against people puffing themselves up, imagining that just because they won a bet, just because they took a chance and it paid off, doesn't mean they're necessarily better than other people. And it doesn't mean that they need to look down on people who are persistent, which is often a temptation of those who are tenacious. They need to see themselves as a set of explorers and see themselves in that wider group and say to, you know, some of us tenacious people, We waste resources for society. We fail. We crash and we burn, and some do really well. And as a class, we're quite necessary, indeed vital, in order to get advancement. But people need to see themselves in that greater context, understanding that, you know, not everything's up to their own control. And there's times where their tenacity could have left, could have led to failure. So that's what I think is going on, is this is the song of the persistent. And that if they had a little bit more self-reflection, they might be able to take that persistence and channel it into the next good end. I think that's what the Oliver Anthony guy did. He looked around at his life and realized things weren't working well. And he identified something which is pretty tried and true. He saw that he could buy a farm, that he could live that kind of bucolic life. And then he doggedly chased that down. That's what he actually did in his real life. So in a sense, although his song doesn't necessarily model what I would suggest, the guy's life isn't that bad as far as modeling the life of a persistent person. All right, well, I'm going to leave it there, guys. I hope you tolerated the poor audio quality and my cold. So, yeah, so points to the listeners today. Oh, I'll add one thing. If you listened to the last episode, I did make a correction, so I'm not sure if everybody caught that one. Listener helpfully pointed out that if you are baptized, you do avoid any temporal debt, and I explain that further in the episode. So if you listen to that one, that'll make sense. If you didn't, well, cool. Listen to the other episode. As always, like this, hit the 5-star buttons, leave a review. I have very few reviews and things like that. If anything, I get more people writing in than any of that. So you can write in, you can review, you can help the show in those ways. And I do appreciate you guys responding to the last time I asked you to do that, because coming out of summer is a time where podcast listens fall off a cliff. And I asked you guys if you could share the podcast with somebody that you knew who might enjoy it. And, well, judging by the analytics, you all definitely did that. So thanks for keeping this growing. It's only you guys that do it. And thanks for listening. As always, I'll talk to you on the next episode.